Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I think we've got a full house, so thank you all for coming. My name is Travers McLeod. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Centre for Policy Development, or CPD, and it's my real privilege and pleasure to welcome all of you to our inaugural John Menadue Oration. Can I start by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land where we're gathered, and pay my respects to the elders of the past, the present, and especially the elders to come. Future generations of the first Australians and those of us who have since joined them are at the heart of tonight's discussion about democracy. When he eulogised Gough Whitlam 3 years ago, almost to the day, Noel Pearson praised Whitlam's belief in the vitality of our democracy as a proper mission of government to be renewed and invigorated. That renewal includes, of course, constitutional recognition, genuine constitutional recognition of our Indigenous Australians. Can I also acknowledge our guest of honour tonight, the former Minister for Foreign Affairs of the Republic of Indonesia, Dr. Marty Natalegawa, his wife, Ibu Sranya, the Indonesian Consul General, Ibu Dewi Wahab, and her husband, Pak Shahija. Thank you very much for joining us and for making this visit possible. In a moment, Pak Marty will be introduced by his great friend, Professor the Honourable Gareth Evans, ACQC, former Australian Foreign Minister, now Chancellor of the Australian National University, and a self-declared incorrigible optimist. That's a plug for the title of Gareth's new book. And memoir. Welcome, Gareth. I'll let you know the commission later on. You're all distinguished guests tonight. Many of CPD's current and former staff are fellows, board members, inaugural board members, former chairs are here. And I want to pay tribute to each and every one of them, led now by our chair, Terry Moran, AC, and Dr. Jenny Whalen, our deputy chair. I've left two acknowledgements till last, but arguably they're the most important because they're the reason we're here. And I speak, of course, of John Menadue and Miriam Lyons. 10 years ago, I was drinking warm beer on a cold day in pre-Brexit Britain. At the same time in Australia, John and Mim became founding chair and executive director of the Centre for Policy Development. John and Miriam were pioneers. They created this organisation because they wanted better ideas for Australia and for evidence to matter. And as another famous Australian might say, we should be so lucky. But in a fractious political and policy environment, I'm proud to say that CPD has built a team and the credibility to cut through and get stuff done, to create, to connect, and to convince on the issues that matter for Australia over the long run. Our Asia dialogue on forced migration now involves 8 countries, international agencies like the UNHCR and IOM, and is helping to change responses to people fleeing persecution. And of course, one of those situations is the catastrophe now unfolding in Myanmar and Bangladesh, with over 600,000 people having fled Myanmar for Bangladesh since violence broke out in Rakhine State 2 months ago. Our research on climate risk has convinced boards, regulators like APRA, and senior military officers to change the conversation about climate risk. We've exposed huge governance and performance gaps in Australia's big service delivery systems, like employment services and settlement services for our most vulnerable new arrivals. And we've uncovered inequity in Australia's schools, pushing persuasively and somewhat successfully to level the playing field. And I pay tribute to one of our fellows, the late Bernie Shepherd, who worked tirelessly to do that and passed away earlier this year. We're proud of this work, not just because it's made a difference, but because we've managed to do it on what is a fairly lean budget by think tank standards. Organisations like CPD don't last for a decade without some brilliant supporters, individuals and organisations who believe in independent policy research in the public interest. And there are too many to list by name, and I won't do justice to their support if I do that, but to all those organisations and individuals who have given generously Some of you here tonight, for every year of our 10 years, can I thank you on behalf of everyone from CPD. As you know, we've named the inaugural lecture after John Menadue, the Menadue Oration, to recognise John's long-standing contribution to public policy in Australia, overseas, and to CPD. The question Puck Marty will address tonight, can democracy deliver, is a perfect question given John's fearless dedication to building a better democracy in Australia, whether it was as ambassador to Japan, a former secretary of the Department of Immigration, a secretary to the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet under Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser, in business, at CPD, as a fellow, and now as a blogger extraordinaire for Pearls and Irritations. Those of us who are lucky to live in Australia don't need to be briefed on the Brexit negotiations or to hear about the histrionics of the Trump administration to realise that democracy and the international rules-based order are under pressure all across the globe. Australia isn't immune to this pressure, quite the opposite. We've framed our 10th anniversary series around democratic renewal because CPD believes that successful democracies are stable but not static. We believe that debates about democracy can't be resolved simply by focusing on trust and leadership. They require a deeper discussion about Australian attitudes to democracy and to government, the connection of those ideas and preferences with more active and effective government, and a clearer shared purpose of what Australian democracy should pursue. Speaking in October 1942, Robert Menzies said, "Australians disagree among ourselves on almost every conceivable subject, but we are all Democrats." For Menzies, democracy was like a piano that had to be played. He said that we must understand and experience democracy if democracy is to be a living faith and is to survive. You're probably wondering, why has CPD asked an outsider to lecture us about democracy? Well, for one thing, sometimes Australia should do less lecturing and more listening. The second reason is often the best way to start a conversation with yourself is with a viewpoint of someone from outside. One in 30 people in the world are Indonesian. It's the third largest democracy in the world, with over 13,000 islands covering a distance equivalent to the gap between London and Tel Aviv. That's about 1/8 of the Earth's circumference. It's our closest neighbour. More people tweet from Jakarta every day than any other city in the world. And in fact, that's a reminder. The hashtag, if you're tweeting tonight, is CPD10, CPD10. Personally, I'm fascinated by the opportunity to hear from Puck Marty as an Indonesian about what he thinks about Australian democracy. Is there something we've forgotten about democracy because we take it for granted? Equally, what can we learn from Indonesia as one of the world's newest and most vibrant democracies? After we've heard from Puck Marty, he'll be joined on stage by Laura Tingle from the Australian Financial Review. Laura was on Q&A this week, but tonight she'll ask the questions and she'll also seek some questions from you before we break for drinks. We're recording tonight, so you will be on camera if you ask a question. Don't let that stop you. And with that, I will hand over to a man who has never shied away from a camera, Gareth Evans, ACQC. Please make him feel very welcome.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Travers, and congratulations to you and all who sail with you on the 10th anniversary of the Centre for Policy Development that we're celebrating here this evening. Thanks for the great contribution CPD has really been making over the last decade in multiple ways, in sprinkling some quality water on the desert that has all too often been the scene for Australian public policy making in recent years. Particular congratulations to your founding chairman, John Menadue, in whose honour the third tonight's oration is named. who, not content with having conquered the commanding heights of government, PM&C, immigration, Ambassador to Japan, commanding heights of major business corporations, news corporation, Qantas, now has assumed, of course, the mantle through his website, Pearls and Irritations, of the nation's stirrer in chief. And we're absolutely delighted to be able to recognise John's contribution in this oration named in his honour. The Australian National University has been very proud to partner now with CPD here in Melbourne over several years in tackling some of the really big questions that face us as a nation, as a region, and as a global community. And few of those questions are really more compelling or consequential than how to meet the various populist and authoritarian challenges to effectively functioning liberal democracy. Born of economic anxiety, security anxiety, cultural anxiety, or very often some toxic mix of all three, challenges of this kind, an authoritarian and a populist kind, are being experienced here in Australia, in our own Asian neighbourhood, and right across the Western world and beyond. Being the incorrigible optimist that I am, I don't think the situation is irretrievable. But it's certainly going to require the political leaders of democracies around the world, particularly the major parties, centre-left, centre-right, who've been losing ground to the populist fringe dwellers in recent years. Certainly going to require them to lift their game by listening more closely to what their peoples are trying to tell them, thinking harder about solutions to some of the biggest problems that we're all facing, not least the future of work in the digital revolution age, and acting in a more sophisticated and cooperative way, in a way that is more compelling to those in the community with half an IQ than the kind of way in which so many of the political leaders have been acting in recent times. Whatever the responses we adopt, it's abundantly clear that we do have to take seriously the current challenges to democracy and the task of democratic renewal. And I frankly can't think of anyone better to stimulate our thinking in this respect than our orator this evening, Dr. Marty Natalegawa, who I'm absolutely delighted personally to welcome back to Australia less than a year after having had the pleasure of awarding him an honorary degree at ANU for his extraordinary contributions both to international peace and security in the Asia-Pacific region and beyond, and also to consolidating and strengthening the bilateral relationship between Indonesia and Australia. Pak Marty, as you know, is Foreign Minister of Indonesia under President Yudhoyono from 2009 to 2014. He'd previously had a highly distinguished diplomatic career serving as Indonesia's permanent representative for the United Nations, and in that capacity, having a stint serving as President of the Security Council. He had been Indonesia's ambassador to the United Kingdom and Foreign Ministry spokesperson, Director General for ASEAN Cooperation. A terrific all-rounder with a fantastic diplomatic pedigree. Pak Marty was influential, very influential, two decades ago in securing acceptance of the Southeast Asian nuclear weapon-free zone. He was influential in positioning Indonesia as the emerging superpower of our immediate region. And he was a very creative problem solver for a number of years over a number of issues which erupted during his term as Foreign Minister, not least in getting Indonesia-Australia relations back on some kind of track, some kind of even keel after the lamentable phone-tapping affair. Pak Marty, Marty Natalegawa, really is as good an Indonesian friend as Australia has ever had. When he was at ANU, earning his first doctorate back in 1993 in international relations for a thesis actually on the regional nuclear weapon-free zone, it's not widely known that he earned his keep in Sarawak by, among other things, throwing newspapers over the fence of suburban houses in Canberra. And certainly he and Sarawak were very deeply engaged in multiple ways in the Australian community. And I think in that context, he learned a lot about the idiosyncrasies of Australian character, which have served him wonderfully well, that knowledge, in his subsequent dealings with us and helps explain why he really has been one of the most affectionately regarded, not just Indonesian foreign ministers, but Asian foreign ministers in our country's history. Since leaving government, Padmati has been kept busy as a member of the UN Secretary General's high-level advisory board on mediation and also as the President of the General Assembly's team of external advisors. As someone who has been involved in Indonesian, regional, global issues for decades now, Marty really does know more than a little about the crucial importance of the democratic project, the absolute necessity of recapturing the primacy of that project as of democracy, as for all its flaws, really the only system of government that begins to honour human dignity and our common humanity. That breadth of depth, the breadth and the depth of the experience that Marty has had, and the acuity of his observations of the human condition and all the time that I've known him, leaves me in absolutely no doubt that we'll be treated to an incredibly illuminating, incredibly thought-provoking lecture this evening on the topic, Can Democracy Deliver? So please join me in welcoming Padmati Natalegawa to the stage to deliver the first Bon Menadue oration.
Thank you very much, Gareth, for that very generous introduction to my remarks. Dear friends and ladies and gentlemen, can democracy deliver? That is the question that has been posed to me by CPD. As one who has traversed Indonesia's now more than decade-long transformative democratic journey, such that today it constitutes the world's third largest democracy, the reply to such a question can only be resoundingly in the affirmative. Indeed, it has to. Democracy must deliver. Throughout all corners of the world, we continue to bear witness to people's yearnings for democracy, for the right to choose and to hold to democratic account their elected representatives, for the protection and promotion of their fundamental human rights, respect for rule of law, for the betterment of their life and their future. Here in East Asia, the decades past remind of some of the most transformative of democratic changes. The return to full democracy in the Republic of Korea and the People Power Revolution in the Philippines, both in the late 1980s, the Reformasi in Indonesia in the late 1990s, and more recently, though still obviously extremely fragile and replete with challenges in Myanmar, the democratic reform that has seen its past advocates for democracy now taking the helm of government. We are today reminded too of the historic magnitude and significance of these developments in East Asia as we contrast the continued fragility of the promise that was once described by some as Arab Spring in parts of the Middle East and North Africa. Unleashing promising reform in some countries and yet triggering internal conflicts and convulsions in others, prompting broader regional and global direct as well as proxy geopolitical tensions, and most tragically, inflicting violence, carnage, and sufferings on the most vulnerable in our societies, children, women, and the elderly. Of peoples in their thousands seeking refuge across borders and continents. However, even in situations of evident democratic transformation, we are reminded too that democracy is a process, not an event. never-ending in its nature and prone to ebbs and flows of progress and regress. Hence, despite some trumpeted gains here in East Asia and beyond, a case can be made of recent signs of shifting dynamics, of democracies adrift, of a changing democratic architecture after decades of promise. For democratic gains have been tempered by challenges both old and new. Of the latter, increasingly we are becoming cognizant of the possible implications to democracy of the advent of new technologies, more positively transformative, some positively transformative in nature, while others illustrative of the potential for their negative exploitations. On the one hand, making information more available with speed and breadth of scope unprecedented before, ushering the potential for a more informed electorate, providing continuous avenues beyond the periodic election cycles for peoples to make known their views and expectations of elected representatives, to hold leaders to greater account and to ensure that they remain sensitive to public interests. As well, through the application of technologies, supporting the holding of elections in countries whose geographic and physical features make for electorates in remote and previously inaccessible regions. Yet, the very same technologies, or strictly speaking, their exploitations, have given rise to new types of concerns and challenges to democracy. Unfortunately, more abundant information has not assured a more informed and open-minded populace as rising signs of intolerance permeate, of dismissals of the position of the other, of denial of inconvenient facts on the one hand, and of the spread of false information on the other, and of the rise and sharpening of particularly divisive politics, of identity politics. Further, while technologies have opened greater opportunities for the voices of the people to be heard, in an age of big data and social media, they have also opened the doors to interferences in elections, the short-term manipulation of the individual's voters' fears and prejudices to secure electoral advantages and victories, and similar concerted manipulation of online conversation to influence public opinion. As some societies grapple with the implications on democracies brought forth by new technologies, it is worthy to remind that in others, the challenges are decidedly far more direct and far more fundamental. Of the absence of peace, of the prevalence of open conflicts, suspending any hope for the exercise of democratic rights as people grapple with the basic task of survival. Of the surge of populist authoritarianism, to see in democracy only as electoral means to acquire power, only to subsequently systematically dismantle and weaken the values inherent in democracy. Of countries once on gradual path to democratic reform, now appearing to have taken pause or indeed to have stepped back. For voices of dissent or simply alternative voices to be silenced by the threat or prospect of legal prosecution. In such complex environment, the management of the nexus or the link between external and internal milieu or environment, so-called domestic and international affairs, has become more critical than ever before. Among others, the promotion and protection of democratic principles in a world of sovereign nation states. Further, the potential impact of more complex and open democratic settings on the conduct of diplomacy. I am of the view that ultimately, democratic reform processes are inherently internal to the countries concerned. However, and this is an important emphasis, this is not to say that there is total absence of the external dimension. The internal and external dimensions are interrelated, and synergies can be attained. Certainly, to be sustained, democracy cannot possibly be imposed from without. There is not a magic wand, a one-size-fits-all, that can apply to all countries with their differing circumstances, past experiences, and visions for their common future. Ours is a world replete with examples of well-meaning efforts to externally and sometimes even forcefully introduce democracy to countries that have ultimately foundered as they lack internal and national sense of ownership, so critical if such processes are to be sustained. However, this is not to say such processes take place in a total vacuum, disconnected from the external milieu. Indeed, I have been of the view that the contemporary world is one in which the distinction between internal and external domains is increasingly becoming tenuous, such that for all practical purposes, they have become one, mutually affecting one another. The term intermestic, perhaps captures such linkage between international and domestic domains. Issues abound, traditionally viewed as internal, that have foreign policy or external dimensions. Food security, energy security, the environment, the management of the economy, migration and the flow of refugees, health, terrorism, simply to cite a few. All of them defy national solutions alone. Does any attempt to promote democratically obtained mandate at the national level on such issues ultimately requires and demands cooperative partnership across nations. Personally, such deep links between the internal and external environments have been the driving motivation to promote ASEAN's democratic architecture, to positively alter the dynamics in the region. As Indonesia embarked on its process of democratic reform post-1998, it deliberately and purposely injected within ASEAN a discourse on democracy, on good governance, and human rights hitherto absent. The resultant ASEAN political security community was groundbreaking for a region more used to seeing such issues as being the exclusive preserve of the individual countries concerned. For the first time, there exists democratic human rights and good governance benchmarks for ASEAN to aspire to and to judge current and future conduct on. More than the establishment of formal ASEAN institutions and capacities, I have sought to deliberately and purposefully introduce state practice within ASEAN to change its dynamics on matters relating to human rights and democracy. At no country's behest or expectation, instead, at its own initiative, Indonesia began to deliberately share developments within the country, the various problems and challenges it was facing internally before ASEAN meetings. The objective was clear and simple: to alter the dynamics within ASEAN such that it becomes more attuned to the principles of democracy, human rights, and good governance. Further, it reflected our confidence and conviction in a democratic response to the various problems that we are facing. In most instances, I must confess that the reaction by the rest of ASEAN member states was awkward and deafening silence, as Indonesia's efforts were not in line with traditional ASEAN practices. However, slowly, ever slowly, the dynamics began to change. Other ASEAN countries also began to share of their internal developments within ASEAN family. such sharing of information began to be viewed not as being interference in internal affairs of ASEAN member states, rather as a natural manifestation of how the ASEAN family of nations can demonstrate genuine concern and interest on internal matters relating to the promotion and protection of principles of democracy, human rights, and good governance that affects the region as a whole. In introducing this as ASEAN's common concern, I was motivated to ensure that the then nascent reform process in Indonesia does not take place in a regional vacuum. Instead, for Southeast Asia region as a whole to move in similar direction, albeit admittedly at a different pace. In essence, therefore, to inject the democratic dynamics within Southeast Asia. In a manner, it was such gradual development of a more nuanced application of the principle of non-interference in domestic affairs, which allowed ASEAN until recently, and I have to emphasize until recently, to navigate the complex process of Myanmar's recent democratic reform, to synergize all the various, often conflicting sets of demands within and outside of Myanmar. I believe it possible to urgently address the current challenge on the Rohingya issue with a similar approach. Clearly, yet another litmus test for ASEAN to demonstrate relevance, to be part of the solution. Recent developments, however, remind of the fragility of the democratization process. Signs abound in Southeast Asia of a shifting democratic momentum and dynamics. And I even perhaps wish to suggest of a democracy adrift and even in retreat. While such ebb and flow are not new and will no doubt continue, today they occur within the context of the much heralded ASEAN community. As a result, this time, there is a sharp and glaring contrast between the actual realities and conditions on the one hand and the avowed and publicly declared commitments on the other. As the initiator of these collective commitments on democracy and human rights in the region, Indonesia has a special responsibility to ensure that there is no backtracking by ASEAN. Indonesia's leadership on this issue has been and will continue to be key. Absent Indonesia's leadership on the issue of democratization and human rights in ASEAN, we can be assured of continued retreat by ASEAN in such important subjects. Absent relentless and continuous efforts of mutual encouragement and support for democratic reform, the dynamics will shift and positive momentums will be lost. There is another manifestation of the nexus between democracy and foreign policy that requires careful and thoughtful management. I am referring here to the idea of the democratization of foreign policy, a phenomenon to be much welcomed. For diplomacy and foreign policy cannot be the exclusive preserve of a few. As a process, it refers to the critical need to promote a sense of public participation and ownership for the effective discharge of foreign policies. In a democracy, the conduct of diplomacy and foreign policy, like other fields of government endeavor, cannot be divorced from the public at large. As outcome, it speaks to the issue of relevance of foreign policies to issues that matters and are of concern to the public at large. Certainly, the foreign policy making environment today is arguably far more complex than hitherto been the case, of wide-ranging constituencies, in particular civil societies, which need to be brought on board, of ever-widening issues that preoccupy the public, issues that have both domestic and external dimensions, and of rapid advances in information technology, which have placed diplomacy and foreign policy in a transformed setting. On the one hand, providing greater opportunity for policy dissemination, while on the other, placing it under an almost continuous public glare and attention. For diplomacy, Such milieu, such a democratic environment, can imply that the management of issues of mutual concern between countries has injected to them internal domestic dynamics to further add to already complex situation. Besides the issue of territorial disputes, perhaps one of the most vivid recent illustration of such complex reality has been over the management of movement of peoples across state boundaries as refugees seeking protection from conflicts and political upheavals. Too readily, such issues have become enveloped by domestic political dynamics in the countries of destination, transit, and origin, making resolutions of the issue even more elusive. The recent surge of refugees to Europe, escaping the conflict in Syria and other parts of the Middle East, is one such illustration, rapidly becoming enveloped in European domestic politics. Of course, I have been particularly aware of the similar dynamics impacting on Indonesia's and Australia's common efforts on the issue of irregular movement of peoples and of refugees, such as through the Bali process. On such and similar issues, I deem it important that policymakers demonstrate constructive leadership and partnership to seek mutually acceptable solutions, not one that aims to score political points of the other with one eye on domestic political consideration. Rather, one that demonstrates the best of our humanity and respect for principles of democracy. In particular, a type of leadership that has the courage and the resilience and persistence to inform the public, to promote a more informed public of the complexities of the issues at hand, the hard choices requiring common undertakings and the search for common solution. The pursuit of narrow populist agenda, however appealing, is to be discouraged. As any neighbors, Indonesia and Australia do not always have a common view on issues affecting them. Precisely as neighbors, however, we do have common issues to manage and address. The task for leaders, past and future, have been to build on such realities and develop common interests between the two countries. I am of the firm opinion that ultimately our democracies have made our relations stronger, our relations more resilient and more robust. Where consensus has proven elusive, we can agree to disagree. We can disagree without being disagreeable. In a world where dialogue and diplomacy are seemingly in retreat, as democracies, Australia and Indonesia can provide a different narrative of the efficacy of diplomacy as a means to address issues amongst nations. Just to go off script, I do genuinely feel that ours is a world that that's not witnessing not only retreat in democracy, but retreat in the art and craft of diplomacy. When disagreements occur, and some of them are extremely telling and difficult differences, actually the incentive and the need for dialogue and diplomacy becomes ever more pertinent, even more pertinent. Unfortunately, we live in a world where dialogue and diplomacy is seen as a sign of weakness, as a sign of appeasement, so to speak. I believe that actually it takes greater courage and demonstration of confidence for parties that differ to actually begin a conversation to address those differences and to manage those differences. Now, Indonesia and Australia have been tested over a number of very difficult issues. But thanks to efforts by colleagues such as Professor Gareth Evans and the late Minister Ali Alatas and all my predecessors before me, and subsequently since then, Indonesia and Australia have always somehow managed to manage the difficulties that we face. And I believe that we have a narrative that we can share to the rest of the world. Friends and colleagues, democracy needs constant investment of efforts, constant nurturing. It is not easy. Indonesia has been going through ongoing transformative process over the past decade or so. We have now a generation of young Indonesians whose formative years are essentially the reformasi years. They are the beneficiaries, in quotes, so to speak, of the reform process that has been underway for well over a decade now. There must not be any complacency. Democracy must be defended. Its values must be defended. If one begins to show lackadaisical and complacent attitude, then the risk of retreat and loss of momentum is very real. Most significantly, I believe that ultimately leaders and institutions must earn the public's trust. I believe that in the final analysis, among the key qualities that any democracy require is that contract, a sense of trust between the electorate and the leaders that they have democratically elected. There is no room for complacency, countenancing attacks against universal democratic values. This is equally the case within nations and among nations. As a final thought, I have to say, Garrett, I feel extremely humbled by the suggestion a fellow from Indonesia, a country that is only just now learning the ropes and going through the difficult democratization process, can be deemed fit to share some thoughts on the issue of democracy. So whatever I share with our friends here in this very august occasion is not meant to pontificate, is not meant to lecture, but simply to share my own personal thoughts, especially how one can manage, how can one promote democratic principles in a world of where we tend to see the world as being internal and external, when in my view, democratic principles are universal in nature. They do not recognize national boundaries. They apply to all citizens, and we must all aspire to ensure that all of us can live a life secure and enriched by the possibility that democracy offers. Thank you very much indeed for your attention.
Well, thank you, Pak Mardi, for that typically humble, gracious, and extremely illuminating lecture. There'll be a vote of thanks later, but you've set an enormously hard act for next year's orator, if not impossible act for them to follow. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, to continue the conversation and explore some of those themes in more detail, would you please welcome to the stage one of Australia's most distinguished and respected journalists, the Walkley Award-winning political editor for the Australian Financial Review, Ms. Laura Tingle.
Thank you, Travis, and nice to see you, Pak Mardi. Now, you've finished your talk being very humble there, but I suppose, and you're a bit sort of pessimistic in tone about democracy being adrift and in retreat, but I suppose the thing that's extraordinary to me is that whatever the shortcomings, you've got a really fascinating perspective from an Indonesian point of view. I mean, yes, there are always problems here, but Indonesia's achieved an extraordinary amount in the last 10 or 20 years in terms of democracy. And I suppose I'd like to draw out some of the threads of some of the things you've had to say tonight, but start in Indonesia, building on that idea of how you democratise foreign policy, but start with the threads of how the sort of democratic institutions in Indonesia have changed and what role they might play in that eventual process. I mean, you talk a lot about the rise of civil society. I mean, how has that actually happened in Indonesia?
Well, thank you very much for that, because it allows me to share some thoughts on to draw attention to and to encourage greater appreciation of the magnitude of the changes that has taken place in Indonesia over the past decade or so. The changes that's taken place in Indonesia over the past decade has been nothing short of transformative. You know, we've had a situation pre-1998, and we had transformed through the so-called reformasi process to become now arguably the world's third largest democracy. And it has taken place in contrast, for example, to developments elsewhere in the Middle East nowadays and parts of North Africa, in a relatively peaceful way. I use that word in a very guarded sense, because I recognize there were difficulties that took place in Indonesia, in Jakarta in particular, during that transition moment. But the democratization process, when it began, was immediately coupled with a number of crises that some describe as being multidimensional in nature, financial, economic, political. Indonesia was, as a state, was being challenged. Its unity was being challenged. But for all those, and then of course there was the issue of terrorism as well. As you remember, of course all of us recall the Bali bombing, 2002 and the like. So we were facing all kind of challenges at multi-front. But on all of them, without any exception, the response was a democratic response. You know, we didn't revert back or try to go back to the situation before, but instead we push ahead. Greater democracy, more autonomy, more decentralization, more governance, institutions and democratic institutions are set up. So that was our response. And of course, one can readily identify challenges throughout dynamics that we need to be managing, issue of how do we manage or promote and celebrate even tolerance in a society that's obviously extremely diverse in its makeup, how we can ensure a proper balance and synergy between the role of the civil society and government and other institutions of state. But, you know, I mean, given where we were before and given where other countries, the kind of experience that others have experienced, Indonesia have a lot to be thankful for, that we have been able to navigate this difficult process in the way that it has. But now the thing is, the nature of the challenge itself has become even more acute. When one identifies challenges, it's not suggesting as if, you know, all is doom and gloom. It's just that we need to be alert and not be complacent. And every generation, and because I see many young Indonesians in this room as well, every generation must contribute. You know, you can't live off, you know, the contributions of the past. Young Indonesians must be robust and must be vocal in defending democratic principles and not to simply be complacent about things. So in drawing out challenges, I'm not, you know, I don't mean to be doom and gloom, but simply to remind all ourselves of the need to constantly nurture and develop our democratic habits and institutions.
As you've said in the speech, Indonesia's got this real leadership role in the ASEAN community as a democratic sort of shining light. I mean, basically, it required all the institutions of Indonesia to say, okay, actually, we're all going to have to change here, I presume. And essentially, most of them did. You know, different, maybe not all with the same enthusiasm, but it did require all of the institutions to change. But I suppose I'm also interested in how important individuals are in that process. You know, I mean, you seem to have been blessed with some sort of really great leaders during that period, but how vulnerable is the sort of democratic idea, both in Indonesia and in ASEAN, to individual leaders still?
Well, you know, I mean, leaders matter. That's why they're described as being leaders. But there is a key difference. There could be a difference between leaders and leadership. In the case of Indonesia and its democratic reform process, from the very beginning, we recognize that to be sustainable and to remain relevant, the democratization process cannot remain a national level only process. We must make it synergic with the broader regional dynamics. But in saying that, we weren't trying to pontificate, we weren't trying to say that we are the model for others to follow, but simply to share lessons learned and our own weaknesses and failings more than our successes, so that others can also hopefully learn and compare notes with us. And in ASEAN, this has been transformative, because I remember back in 2002 when we began to introduce the idea of democracy and human rights in ASEAN, not only were our ASEAN colleagues extremely cynical, but actually even within Indonesia, there were many who questioned such an effort because they say, why are you trying to concentrate on regional developments when we are not even properly done yet within? But at the time, we thought this has to be done simultaneously. You can't achieve certain state of perfection before you proceed to do other things. You know, so we did things simultaneously, sharing and drawing lessons learned of one another's experience. And things actually began to change, to be honest. And you know, countries began to become more comfortable in discussing issues of human rights, democracies within ASEAN. But the point that I was trying to make is that if Indonesia doesn't continue to prod and push this process forward, then it will grind to a halt. Because this is not finance, it's not to do with, I mean, in economics, in ASEAN economic cooperation, the market forces will do things for you. I mean, things will happen irrespective of government decisions. But in the case of issues such as democracy and human rights and good governance, it requires a great deal of hand-holding, strong encouragement. And here, I think the role of leaders, we tried very hard to make sure that the ASEAN has all the necessary mechanism and capacities so that it can withstand changes in leadership among ASEAN leaders. So we have the ASEAN Charter, ASEAN Human Rights Declaration, to be sure that whoever comes and goes, as there is a certain minimum standard. It seems we are not there yet, because to be honest, we have all the paraphernalia, we have all the declarations, the resolutions, the treaties concerned, but all that comes to nothing if ASEAN member states are not willing to empower such capacities. And I think this is where we are now. Where the challenge for us now, yeah.
And it's probably sort of one of the more depressing signs, I suppose, that unless Indonesia's doing it, there hasn't been enough sort of momentum built in the other ASEAN member states, from what you're saying, to suggest that there's going to be any forward momentum.
Yes. Well, it is. Ultimately, it has to be a common effort, because, of course, Indonesia can try to lead, there has to be a sense of ownership, a sense of participation. All ASEAN member states must bring something to the table. Unfortunately, as Gareth has just now explained as well at the beginning, I get the sense, as a layperson looking from outside to within, the democratic dynamics, the democratic architecture is shifting in a negative way in our region. And what worries me a little bit is that not only is it shifting, but there is a deafening silence to what we are seeing. See, I mean, things happen. Of course, there will be ebbs and flows. There will be positives and negatives. That's a given. But what worries me is that there is a degree of silence to the obvious retreat that we are seeing. And especially Indonesia, as the country that actually brought forth this agenda, we have a huge responsibility. You can't bring something to the table, and then when things happen, we suddenly disappear. And this is, I think, the need for Indonesia to speak up, because others want, and we have to speak up on such issues.
So there seem to be these two conflicting trends, if you like. As you say, the sort of linking up of foreign and international policy, the policy goes across state borders in so many areas, is happening on the one level, which should actually potentially offer some good things, because it does mean that there are these outside forces just challenging the domestic relationships. But from what you're saying, a lot of that retreat is also a retreat inside internal borders, as we've seen in other parts of the world.
Absolutely. So it's a complex, mutually influencing dynamics within and outside, within the countries concerned, in the region as a whole. So I believe in dynamics in terms of virtuous dynamics as well as a vicious one. Mm. And whether it's negative or positive, it's a policy decision. It's a consequence of policy makers. Mm. Policy makers have this wonderful opportunity to make a difference. That's what I really appreciate, having gone through a certain experience, that you have a wonderful opportunity to make a difference. You try, you fail, that's perfectly fine. At least you draw lessons learned from your failure, because most of the lessons learned are drawn from failure, I believe, rather than from successes. But what worries me again is that given such opportunity and given such challenges, if leaders are not actually stepping up and actually be a bit more shaping and molding, and not simply be reacting. Mm. But again, by way of context, Southeast Asia compared to other regions, North Africa, Middle East, have a lot to be appreciative of. But still, we mustn't be complacent. Mm.
A lot of what you say strikes a chord. I was in Germany recently covering the elections there, and while I was there, I watched President Macron's speech to the Sorbonne, the first 45 minutes of it, and he went for 2 hours. you've got to say he's quite ambitious and optimistic. He's going to fix Africa and the Middle East and a few other things along the way. But I thought what was fascinating about what he was saying was you're at this point in Europe where a lot of countries are saying, the EU, it survived all the various national elections, but this sort of antipathy towards the European Union, which is seen as the cause of the problems on migration, for example. But what Macron was turning around and saying was, actually, no, the EU isn't the cause of the problems, it's actually the solution, because collectively we can find solutions to this. We actually need each other to find a resolution on refugees, for example. I just wonder whether ASEAN is sort of an idea that's developed enough and its member states are sort of at a point where you could see sort of a similar discussion taking place in ASEAN if somebody was to actually prosecute the case?
Well, in a way, ASEAN has, because ASEAN has been far less, it hasn't affected people's life as the EU has, the degree of its influence and impact, and therefore any shortcomings faced at the national level have not been leveled against ASEAN in the way there is an anti-Brussels or anti-EU sentiment within some of the capitals. But at the same time, I think many of us in many parts of the world are now dealing with a sense of anti-globalization. I think one of the key challenges that Indonesian policymakers and future leaders have to grapple with is how one can promote a sense of national identity, a sense of patriotism, even in a globalized world that can synergize national and global outlook, not seeing in things as being an either or, globalization as something to be won by one party, and there must be, if someone wants to be winning it all the time, someone has to be losing at the same time. But our mindset must be one of mutual benefit. Any endeavor has to be in that way, in my view. And I think it is the role of leaders to actually manage expectations. You can't overpromise. But at the same time, I think for organizations such as the EU or ASEAN, they must demonstrate relevance. You can't just have constant meetings and the like disconnected from the ordinary, the people's concerns. So I guess that's what I meant by democratization of foreign policy. Foreign policy is always bound to be restrictive in the sense that decisions have to be made by decision makers. It can't be like a mass decision by everyone unless we begin to adopt a referendum for every issue that comes to mind. But at the same time, leaders need to ensure that the issues that is being discussed are of relevance to the public at large. That's a major challenge, I think, yeah.
So what's the positive sales pitch that you'd put to the Indonesian people about ASEAN then?
Well, it has been transformative. Transformative in changing relations among Southeast Asian countries. Not 5 decades ago, before ASEAN, countries in Southeast Asia were at war with one another. If not at war, there was a huge trust deficit, high degree of suspicion of one another, and yet over 5 decades, we have transformed that. Now we have strategic trust. The notion of having open conflict among ASEAN states now has become almost unthinkable. And I think that is a major plus, so that all of us can concentrate on our economic development efforts. Not only that, ASEAN has allowed or made possible the transformation in terms of the role of regional countries. They were once only pawns in major power rivalries during the Vietnam conflict, and yet here we are now arguably central to the region's architecture building. So at least for those two reasons, ASEAN has been transformative and of relevance, securing the peace between Southeast Asian countries and elevating our role in the wider region. But, and of course, this has been beneficial to all countries of ASEAN. But if, in the end, the general populace must be assured that it is thanks to ASEAN and policies that ASEAN has made possible that such conditions are able to be enjoyed. So the case must be constantly made.
Well, one of the biggest transformations of really recent times is in Myanmar. Yes. But we've seen, the whole crisis around the Rohingyan population. If you were still Indonesian foreign minister, what would you be doing about that?
Thankfully, I'm not. In whatever capacity, if I was in a position to effect change, I would be in Myanmar now, right? I mean, you have to be there. Myanmar, ASEAN has been consumed by Myanmar issue for more than a decade before. Every ASEAN meetings was all about Myanmar. Myanmar. And ASEAN was defined by the developments in Myanmar. In 2011, when Indonesia chaired ASEAN, in January 2011, we said at the end of the year, we will be done with this portfolio. Yeah. And it wasn't by accident. Purposefully and deliberately, that's what I said before, policymakers can make a difference. I don't believe for those who say, well, the hands are tight, things can't be done, it's too difficult. With perseverance, you can change things. And at the beginning of 2011, we saw what the opportunity, and we worked closely with Myanmar, basically to ensure that they have that our trust to navigate the situation. And I think now, beyond the mechanics, I think the first thing and foremost is that individual ASEAN member states or ASEAN collectively must once again earn the confidence and be of Myanmar authorities that they can be strong partner in pushing this issue through, managing it, and making sure that the rights of the Rohingya population of Myanmar are protected. So I think Otherwise, at the moment, our conversations are being done elsewhere. And I fear that the situation is becoming increasingly difficult. So talking with the Myanmar authorities, understanding doesn't mean you are appeasing or you are justifying what, but just trying to understand what is their thinking behind this, what makes them tick, and how one can address this core issue, the problem, because it won't be resolved overnight, but certainly fundamental to it must be the rights of the Rohingya population of Myanmar. I was fortunate enough, actually, together with our consul general, to visit our present consul general, by the time, to visit Rakhine State, and I remember when we visited one of the few ASEAN forum. I mean, I think the only time as ASEAN foreign minister was allowed to go to the area. You talk to these people, and they start passing you little notes. They pass you little notes, and they just push it, shove it into your pockets. Once I returned home, I opened up the notes, and very touching letter to say, please help, because they are not able to say what they really want to say in front of all the accompanying delegation at the time. And seeing what we are seeing now, I'm just wondering what has become to all those who were then in the camps back in 2012, 2013. But this is an issue that really requires immediate solution. I can't imagine, honestly speaking, in a week's time, I'm sorry to say this, but I can't imagine ASEAN leaders congregating in Manila for their summit to have some kind of a celebratory moment, really, for 50th year of ASEAN, which is a wonderful occasion to be celebrated, to be commemorated, to be happy about. But at the same time, we have this situation on our doorstep. I'm not saying that it has to be resolved before then, but please show a roadmap. Demonstrate relevance. You can't just pretend as if it's not before us all. And otherwise, it just looks so surreal for ASEAN to be celebrating in the way it's celebrating when we have this huge crisis before us. The summit will be a very important sign, so demonstrate to what extent ASEAN is actually on top of this issue, I think, next week.
Because it is about talking to Myanmar and the authorities there, but it's also now basically a regional crisis with all the displaced people. A lot of people would say that that it's over. It's not going to be reversed. So, do you think ASEAN can play a role in trying to find a way of accommodating a lot of people who don't want to go home?
Well, I think we have to proceed step by step. We need to have a clear roadmap of what the eventual solution, so to speak, would be. Ultimately, the right of return must be secured and safeguarded. Not forcible return, the right of voluntary return. But I think even at this apparently late stage, there is still a great deal to be done in terms of managing the situation, making sure that it doesn't become even more widespread. The phobias demonstrated against particular religion, for example. Mm. So there is still a lot to be gained, even at this 11th hour, in managing the crisis, if not actually solving it outright. So it's never too late. It's never a bad moment to start something that is worthwhile undertaking. And with the passage of time, it becoming even more deafening, ASEAN silence on this issue. Mm.
Let me ask you about the relationship between Australia and Indonesia. The Labor Party has been starting to rework its foreign policy positioning. And one of the points that has come out in the last few weeks is the suggestion from the Shadow Treasurer that there should be a regular economic dialogue as there is a security dialogue. And I've got to say, I suddenly thought, we don't have one. This is extraordinary. It made me wonder about, I know you're sort of arguing, there's no point just having lots of dialogues and relationships unless they're doing something, but how would you draw up those sorts of structures between Indonesia and Australia? I mean, where are we lacking and what should we be doing? Because it seems crazy that there isn't more focus on the relationship.
Well, to be honest, and I stand to be corrected because it's been some time since I dealt with the portfolio directly, but actually in terms of modalities, in terms of infrastructure, so to speak, there is actually a number of processes that has been introduced. The political meaning foreign affairs to foreign affairs, 2+2, foreign and defense. And actually, before and probably during Gareth's time as well, there was already a platform, a forum, where it was an interministerial dialogue. So it wasn't just the foreign and defense and defense and respective portfolio. It was actually a multi-ministerial annual meetings to grow through all the portfolio of issues and to be better coordinated. But as is often the case in this kind of setup, it's easy to start, but difficult to sustain, because ministers have other activities, and after the inaugural first meeting, then things sort of lapse. And this is where the role of the senior officials become extremely key, because they need to maintain the momentum at the more practical official levels to be sure that there is a good to-do list, what's left to be done, like a scorecard, I think the term we used before, to measure progress. But this must be constantly renewed. Before adding new structures, I think it's very, very important and sensible to look at what we already have so that we don't simply add to new one and not add new ones. We look at what we have, make sure that where the gaps are, what the shortcomings have been. But not least of all, I think in the final analysis, there's a key the need to ensure that the private sectors and the non-governmental, whether it be private sector in terms of commerce or the other actors, are actually involved, and it has to be a public-private partnership process. And obviously, Indonesia and Australia have a very sound, close relationship. But in terms of manifest, concrete trade investment potentials, we are always. I don't have a figure in front of me, but I'm told that we are always reminded of how much more we can do better in terms of the potentials ahead of us. Yeah.
Do you think? I mean, a lot of people in Canberra will say to you the fact that we've got all these, we've got summit season, you know, each year with APEC and G20 and East Asia Summit and all those things is good because it does mean that world leaders are meeting really regularly in a much more informal way. But it does sort of clog up the calendars with people looking for things to talk about as well, I suspect. Yeah. I mean, what's your feeling on that?
I don't know. I'm a great believer of the importance of the process. I think more. I know that it's now quite fashionable and quite politically correct to complain and lament about too many meetings, but I think actually it's very important for leaders, for policymakers, for ministers to constantly engage one another. You know, I mean, it's never enough. So we need to know one another better. And so when real problem arises. You know, at least we have the benefit of knowing one another personally already, and it always helps. It never hinders. And when I, with all ASEAN, I mean Australian foreign ministers, of course, when Gareth was foreign minister with Minister Ali Alatas, I was just then a third secretary or second secretary, freshly joining our foreign ministry. But since then, I have had only the most wonderful of relationship and camaraderie with all the former Australian foreign ministers, of which there have been several during my time. And I benefit as a result, to be honest, thanks to ASEAN, I mean ASEAN, Australia's very robust political system. I have now so many ASEAN, I mean Australian foreign ministers, former to be having good relationship with. But with all of them, without exception, whenever problems arise with Bob Carr, with Stephen Smith, with Kevin, and of course Julie Bishop, Minister Julie Bishop, we can always, first of all, before we deal with the problem, let's understand each other's political space. What kind of space do we have? So a good agreement requires the agreement to be mutually acceptable. You can't have 100% victory by one side over the other, because that's not a, it won't be sustainable, it won't be implementable. So we have to know, by showing empathy, we are not demonstrating weakness, but we are just being realistic. And I must say, having the benefit of communicating intensely with all the various policymakers in the past, it has only put me in a better stead, actually, to address problems. So what a wonderful, it's a quality time when leaders meet, they can solve problems. Imagine that. I mean, this is a fantastic opportunity to make a difference. Yeah.
A lot of flaws in the Indonesian democracy, but I would have said quite a lot in the Australian democracy these days. But is there anything you look at in our democracy and sort of think, gee, I'm a bit jealous of that? Or do you actually look at it and say, thank goodness it's not us?
Yeah, well, Indonesia's democracy is a young democracy, right? I mean, it's only a decade or so old. And, one takes for granted just the right to be, the fact that you are able to freely choose come election time in a very robust, one thing that I can identify. One thing I admire about Australian politics over the political system is that, to me, the choices appear to be clear in terms of policy implications. So we have not only personalities, of which there are quite a few, and obviously to be successful politicians, you have to have certain personalities and gravitas, but at least you can actually look clearly the policy differences, the manifesto called in the old days, in the 70s, 80s, we used to call them political manifestos. I'm not sure what it's called nowadays, but you can see this is what Labour stands for, what the other parties, the Liberals stands for. So it's a clear policy choices. And in most instances, the policy choices, especially in the domain of the economic domain, financial finances, they are actually budgeted for. You can actually see how such programs are to be attained and what the implications. But in other democracies, and I don't want to specifically mention Indonesia, but in other democracies, it's more personality, to be honest. Yeah, I mean, I am aware of personality A, personality B, personality C, but I'm not sure what the politics, I mean, what is their personal, and what is the outlook? How are they going to change Indonesia? I mean, what are the concrete policy choices that they're making? Of course, they have your data, they tweet, things like, but really, ultimately, because we as the electorate, we need to know what, these are very important choices. And I admire the way that the mature, democracies such as Australia, in Australia, at least there appear to be clear delineation. The manifesto is clear. One can make some kind of informed decision. But in other democracies, often it's more personality driven. Hence, we have situation where if you fail in one effort and then you set up your own, a new party again. So it's very much idiosyncratic, I think. I would say that's one characteristic of Australian politics, I guess a Westminster-type model politics that where the policy choices are made crystal clear even before one goes to the ballot box, yeah.
We have to wind up, but I'd be fascinated in, you know, one more observation from you, you know, having had such a fascinating career so far, about Australia. You studied here in the 1990s when we had a Prime Minister who wanted Australia to be part of Asia. Now, a lot has changed, you know, in the balances and events since Paul Keating was saying that. Indonesia itself was a completely different world. But what would you, or how would you structure an elevated role for Australia in Asia now, if you were given the job of constructing it, what would be your priorities?
Well, I think the first point to be made is to really appreciate how forward-looking and how transformative Australia's outlook then was. You know, as Australia spoke of the importance of the Asia Pacific, people like Gareth through APEC and the like, far earlier than many other countries that eventually also come around to the same recognition. So Australia has always been actually out there in ahead of the curve, so to speak, in recognizing the importance of the Asia Pacific, the importance of engagement with the Asia Pacific. Sometimes, to be honest, I get a little bit frustrated in a good way, in the sense that I often read about question marks about at the time, at least, whether is Australia part of the Pacific or whether it's not, like a constant self-doubt and self-critique almost. But for me, it's whether it's be geography, whether it's geopolitics, whether it's geoeconomics, Australia is evidently and clearly part of the region, and there is not a gatekeeper to be holding Australia back. You just simply have to continue doing what you have been doing and then immerse yourself in the region's dynamics, as Australia has done. So I think Australia shouldn't be too, contract out or to provide an opportunity for others to be like the gatekeeper, that you can enter only if you do A, B, and C. So because I think you are a full, paid member and part of this region. That's a geographical, geopolitical, and geoeconomic fact of life. But having said that, I think it's very prudent and important for Australia to be working together with its partners in the region. And I think there is nothing broken at the moment, to be honest, because Australia has been out there with APEC, with ASEAN Regional Forum, the ASEAN Plus One, East Asia Summit, original, and East Asia Summit since then with Australia, with US and Russia's admission. So Australia has been very active. But now I think Australia needs to sit together with key countries of the region to identify what are the futures ahead of us. Not just the past 50 years of ASEAN type, but what are the future challenges? And I think this is where ASEAN leadership and relevance can be critically important. Gareth earlier in one of our sessions spoke of potential collaboration between countries like Indonesia and Australia on nuclear disarmament issues. This is a very important issue nowadays with North Korea, with the nuclear prohibition treaty and the like. So this is the kind of intellectual leadership and contribution Australia can make. I wouldn't be too immersed in the issue of membership of this and that group. It shouldn't be made into, I believe, a 21st century cooperation is no longer of the 20th century type. You know, the 20th century type is about membership of organization A or B or C. But nowadays, I think everything is issue dependent. We have to be a bit more agile and a bit more adaptive. The membership, so to speak, of any effort is dependent on the issue. You can't have a monopoly of wisdom just among the 10 or among the 18 countries, but it depends on the issues. And if Australia can identify issues that is of relevance to the entire region, whether it be on nuclear disarmament, on other issues of mutual concern, then Australia can take the lead. But it would be wise and prudent, I think, to have a strong partner of the region so that you are not found to be too far ahead, so to speak. So we have a good partnership. But Australia mustn't feel, must recognize it has been part of the region architectural building from the very beginning, and now we have a critical opportunity to contribute ahead. We have an ASEAN-Australia summit, I think in March or April this year, I think to commemorate a special summit in Sydney, or if I'm not mistaken. I think between now and then, this is the most important and critical time for someone to put on their thinking cap, to think, so that we have not only a meeting, a summit where people come and have wonderful statements made, but Australia, I think, must come up with a clear suggestion on how ASEAN and Australia can make a difference for the next 50 years of ASEAN. And almost thinking, almost starting from anew, almost. But it's a wonderful opportunity. I hope the forthcoming summit will not be a missed opportunity, and ASEAN, Australia actually comes up with a sound and wonderful contribution.
Pak Marty, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Well, what a privilege it has been for us to all be here this evening. My name is Sam Mostyn. I am very grateful to the chair of CPD, Terry Moran, and to Trav, who you met earlier this evening, for inviting the newest member of the board of CPD to offer the vote of thanks on your behalf this evening. I'd like to start, though, by acknowledging again John Menadue, because it seems to me, John, that tonight has been an exercise in leadership, and you exercised that leadership alongside Miriam Lyons a decade ago. And it seemed to me tonight, sitting here listening to both the words in the speech but also in that marvellous conversation, that we owe you a great debt for the effort that you and Susie really put in and continue to put into the intellectual process in this country. And it was against all odds. And to be sitting here a decade later for a quality of conversation and a presentation from Pak Marty of the kind we've heard tonight is really it's a perfect tribute to you as the inaugural oration. I'd also like to acknowledge Gareth. Wonderful introduction, I think, in light of Pak Marty's comments that came afterwards, about the act and art of diplomacy. I think it was a nice reference to you and a tip of the hat to you, but also your fondness and the affection with which you made the introduction was quite apparent, and it was delightful to have you here and to join us for today's conversations and tonight in particular. Laura, you make my Sunday mornings much better if you turn up on Insiders. And you also made Monday night so much better on Q&A. There are very few journalists and commentators who could go the rounds with Kevin Rudd and come out with the Twitterati claiming that you were the smartest on the panel. So, and I was following very closely to see how Twitter rated the night, given that our former Prime Minister was on a panel that Laura was on. But your insights and your take on not just our political system, but as has been evidenced tonight with the breadth of your understanding of the region, ASEAN, and your conversation with Pak Marty, could you thank Laura for her wonderful presentation? And that brings me to the marvellous address that we were treated to tonight from Pak Marty. I'm sure I say on behalf of all of us, it was a rare privilege, Marty, for us all to be here. I did have some prepared remarks having thought about your speech, but just sitting and listening to you tonight, I felt myself so moved by the quality of your language and the words that just kept popping out to me as someone interested in the topic was quite different to the kinds of addresses we're used to. I retired today as president of the Australian Council for International Development, which is the peak body for the 130 international aid and development organisations in Australia. And we've spent 2 days discussing Australia's relationship with the world and the region, and we were joined by 20 Indonesian postgraduate students who are the recipients of DFAT's Australia Awards, who come to Australia to study and to learn. And so we were deep in conversation about what's happening with democracy, and we really enjoyed the Indonesian young people's conversations with us. We had a number of speakers, including Francis Adamson from DFAT, who was marvellous about these topics, Connie Ferravanti-Wells, who enlightened us about the program for the government currently has for our International Aid and Development Program. Penny Wong this morning really gave us a sense of what a foreign policy might look like under Labor. It was all about Australian values. It drew on, as Laura pointed out, consultations taking part around the country about our foreign policy informed by deep conversations. And only last night we awarded our annual Sir Ron Wilson Award, our Peace Prize. Normally it goes to people or a person who delivers matters to the external world, to the international environment. And last night we awarded it for the first time really to a very strong domestic issue, which will bring me back to your speech. And we awarded it to the co-chairs of the Referendum Council, Pat Anderson and Mark Liebler, as a mark of solidarity and respect for the work that's been done on the Uluru Voice and the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And the reason we did that, I think, was really borne out by your speech, which I'd like to come to now, which was about your term, the intermestic, that we were awarding, as people interested in the world and our place in the world, our highest honour to a group of Indigenous people who are fighting for recognition in this country and are trying to help us resolve an internal domestic matter that I think places our strength into the region and the world in a far higher order. And so I was really struck by the words then that were emerging from your very thoughtful presentation. So the words that struck me was when you started talking about democracy is a process and not an event, you then ended with it as if it is a grand project. It's not just a project, it's a project that's built on trust. It's tempered by so many attributes that you then spoke about. You used the terms human rights a lot. You used words of collaboration, of collective response, of common concern. You talked about inserting the concerns of Indonesia into the ASEAN process when that was risky and when the ASEAN would have felt that that was an embarrassing moment for a country to reveal its own internal domestic problems. But you said you inserted it as an act of democratising within ASEAN. So you have been on a constant journey that involves a common concern for the region and a common concern that Australia should be party to. And your language really, I think, encourages us as we think about our contribution to Australia's white paper on our foreign policy and our relationship with Indonesia, that there are some very strong but fairly old-fashioned principles here of stewardship, of friendship, of fellowship, of your long relationship with Australia, having studied here, but your humility and your capacity to look at the world humbly and yet still find a role for Indonesia, a role for Australia, but in the words of human rights and the traditions of human rights, and tonight to then be able to call on us to act on what the events, the terrible events in Myanmar, and to talk about what you would be doing at the moment. And I think ultimately your presentation told us that none of us can be silent. You actually give us a form of leadership that's about stepping up and standing up and not being frightened of old-fashioned principles of collaboration, conversation, and getting to know one another, people to people. And for that, I think we are terribly grateful for a very meaningful and heartfelt presentation tonight, well beyond the topic, but it was an act of leadership, and I'd like you all to join me in thanking Pak Marty. I have a few gifts to give Laura and Pak Marty in a moment, but before we do that and we come and join you, I just wanted to close on behalf of Travis to say that the work that CPD is doing, as you can see from tonight and some of the work that I hope you follow, that CPD is doing remarkable and important work. I've been quite close to the work that Travis and the team have done on the climate risk strategy, and single-handedly, with some partners, carefully chosen, CPD has changed the discussion and the debate and the responsibilities of Australian company directors on climate risk. That was a coordinated, beautifully handled, extraordinarily well-conducted set of research programs that were done, led by the team at CPD. It's a small but highly effective team, which has forever changed the way boardrooms will now talk about climate risk. Don't underestimate the power of that change in this country. The team brings together unusual suspects all the time on the most important matters that help us find a common cause. Again, back to Pak Marty's speech tonight. Two members of the team deserve very much thanks for tonight, Shivani and Louisa, who have convened tonight. So would you please also thank Shivani and Louisa? And all that remains for me to say, other than please keep an eye on CPD, it's doing some of the most important work, and I think in the spirit of our orators this evening, it's work that must be done to help inform a better public debate in this country and to make sure that we are protecting our democracy and involved in that grand project. So perhaps what we now need to do is go and have a drink. There is a lovely courtyard just across from the exit to this hall. We'd love you all to come and have a drink, to experience a bit of fellowship and chatting, to meet Pak Marty, and join us in what we hope is a really fruitful set of discussions before we go off into our worlds again tonight. Thank you very much for attending and look forward to having a drink.